Phil, for those who just turned on in the half-hour break, this is Mae Brussel, KLRB in Carmel, talking about dialogue assassination. We're doing a little obituary, a few comments on J. Edgar Hoover in memory of his departure, and pointing out some of the things that are not put into the newspaper that you read.
Right, and the program is Dialogue Assassination, which deals with political assassinations and the news of the day as it relates to what Mae says is the general scheme of things. Why don't we pick up now where you were talking about this book about the CIA, which won't be published.
Yeah, what I wanted to say was that I have many books on the intelligence system, like The Espionage Establishment, and White Tie and Dagger, and so forth, but none of these books are against Richard Helms or the Central Intelligence Agency or the way he got his power. If you read the books carefully, there's enough to make your hair stand on end about the Central Intelligence Agency, particularly the last three books that came out the first of the year on Reinhard Gehlen, the Nazi general.
Now, this book, you say this is the first time in the history of any nation in the world that a book has been suppressed by a judge before it's been published?
In this nation. First time
in the United States?
Yes.
The judges actually forbid publication?
Yeah,
of the book?
A federal district judge, I'll read this to you from the newspaper. A lot of people wonder why I make such broad assertions or statements, and I do like to read articles or from the book because I'm not making it up. A federal judge, district judge, refused Friday to relax a temporary restraining order to let a former Central Intelligence Agency agent circulate a novel about the CIA to publishing houses, despite protests from the American Civil Liberties Union lawyer that no other judge in this nation's history has restrained publication of fiction. Judge Albert Bryan declined to modify the restraining order. They argued that Marchetti might disclose thinly disguised secrets under the guise of fiction. The government was to have presented witnesses to support its claim that the publication of a nonfiction book could cause grave and irreparable injustice and injury to the United States.
That's another book that Marchetti's writing.
Well, this is the one they're stopping from coming out. You see, and now the case has been reset until May the 15th. I think the government tried to stop the Pentagon Papers and got a court proceeding to halt those until they decided about the who would be injured by the publication. And the people that are injured by the publication of the Pentagon Papers are the men who lie and double deal, give public speeches, and proclaim a certain policy for the United States that they are telling you about their position as each day rolls along, and they are actual downright liars. Jack Anderson went before a congressional committee this week and said Richard Nixon is a liar. Now, that's as strong a language as I've heard said by somebody before the congressional committee. He said he lied. He was talking about the Freedom of Information Act, and Anderson accused Nixon personally of lying to congressional leaders about the India-Pakistan policy, and he said the administration, in quotes, lies through its teeth over such matters as the whereabouts of Foreign Affairs Advisor Henry Kissinger. And Anderson asked in an appearance before the House Government Information Subcommittee, currently reviewing the working of the Freedom of Information Law. He talked about what he said was the unjustified secrecy surrounding foreign policy and defense. And he feels that these things should be open and not should be, the government should not be run in secret. And this is what I tell people about the National Archives locking up the proof of who killed John Kennedy or Robert Kennedy or Martin Luther King or 200 or 300 other people whose names I have. This is all done in secret. Now, when they say, when the judge says in Alexandria, Virginia, that this information may do grave damage to the United States, that's only his opinion, because people should know what's going on at the Central Intelligence Agency. This man blew his cover. He worked there for many years as a very fine agent. And he feels the American people have to know. This is why he's writing a book. And there was a story written up, I think, the February issue of Computer and Automation about Marchetti, Victor Marchetti. So the federal government has laws and judges to stop you from seeing what is available. I talked to a gentleman on the phone last night, and he didn't understand my tax case against the government based upon the secrets that are locked up that would prove how Johnson became president, or Richard Nixon became president. And he said, well, Johnson's succession to the throne was an orderly procession, and while people talk about conspiracy, there has never been proof yet of the conspiracy. And I explained that the proof is marked top secret and can't be seen for 75 years, and they don't have the right to lock that up from us. I will say he has the right to be president after I see the evidence. Now, getting back to the obituary of J. Edgar Hoover was one of the most shocking articles this week that came out of the newspapers. It was in the San Jose Mercury and the Monterey Herald. No other paper that I have has it so far. I take eight a day. The title of the article says, "Almost Everything Goes at the Auction of Jack Ruby." And the gist of the article is this. In a town called Athens, Texas, the furnishings of Jack Ruby, the nightclub owner who shot Lee Harvey Oswald in jail when he was handcuffed 2 days after the killing of President John Kennedy, the belongings of Jack Ruby were sent to a man in Athens, Texas, by the name of Mr. Ware. And he runs an auction parlor. His name is L.J. Ware. And he's a partner in the Athens Transfer and Storage Company. And they ran an auction. And I'm going to read to you from the newspaper what happened at the auction.
Who sent these goods?
Now, the belongings of Jack Ruby were furniture, which he says was very fancy things. It was none of this cheap stuff. He said his furnishings came from Boston, New Hampshire, and those kind of places. But among the things auctioned in Athens, Texas, was a safe, which served as Ruby's office safe at the Carousel Club. And it was sent to Athens, Texas, where it was, in quote, stolen this last weekend, Friday morning or Thursday night, and Ware said he did not know what was in the safe. He said he made an agreement. Now listen to this, Phil. Mr. Ware made an agreement never to try to open the safe before it was sold at the auction.
And made an agreement with who?
Well, that's what I want to know. I cross-filed this article into 11 different subjects for my filing system, and I'll show you. That is one of the questions. Who does Mr. Ware of an Athens transfer company make an agreement with never to open the belongings of Jack Ruby?
Who sent the belongings to Ware?
That's another person. I have that listed here under witnesses not called before the Warren Commission. J. Edgar Hoover is head of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the Dallas police collected the belongings of people involved in the political assassination. Now, Ruby, you can't take lightly, because if he didn't kill President Kennedy, he killed the man who said, "I didn't do it." He killed the man who said, "I'm a patsy." While he was alive for 2 days, Oswald said, "I didn't do it." Locked up in the National Archives for 75 years are all the papers on Jack Ruby. I have a list of what's in the National Archives, and through this Freedom of Information Act, we should be able to see what's locked there for 75 years. I have a copy of a letter that I've read on a different show from a lawyer working for the Warren Commission to another lawyer, and it was dated 1 week before the Warren Report went to press. And he said, on the chapter under conspiracy with Jack Ruby, we can't say that there was no conspiracy involving Jack Ruby and the people related to the assassination because we haven't gone into that matter. All we can say in the wording of the Warren Report that as far as we have researched and examined, there was no conspiracy. So by their own admission, we have now the fact that everything that belonged to Ruby is top secret, 75 years locked up in the archives. And what was in his personal safe, these were his business working papers, who he knew, who he saw, who he wrote letters to, was sealed up 9 years, Phil, sealed 9 years, and delivered on a truck to Athens, Texas. When I read the article, I wondered, who is in Athens, Texas? I've never heard of the town. Ruby came from Illinois, and it's certainly a far-out place, not in Dallas, to auction it. He lived in Dallas many years. Why in Athens, Texas? But when you read the book on Hank Messick, on J. Edgar Hoover, he refers to the town, on page 145, he refers to this town where Sid Richardson, the oil billionaire, and Clint Murchison lived. That was their home in Athens, Texas. I think they owned the whole town, and I know that a very important woman in that town, Sylvia Odio, who had information of the political assassination, who was an important witness before the Warren Commission, when her testimony got too hot, and after the assassination, she was housed in the home of a man whose father works for Clint Murchison. Sylvia Odio was picked up right away and stayed in this particular domicile. But his things went to Athens, Texas, where boyhood friends Clint Murchison and Sid Richardson grew up. Richardson passed away, and I forget the figure. John Connolly was the attorney for that estate that came into millions and millions of dollars, just being the executor of Sid Richardson's estate. John Connolly got that windfall. So Jack Ruby's safe was removed. Now, Ware said he made an agreement never to open the safe before it was sold. And the question, we have to repeat it, because I go too fast sometimes, is who does this transfer man make an agreement with, and how did he get it? If J. Edgar Hoover is running the investigative agency of this country, how did this man get it? Now, what happened to the safe? He says the safe was worth $250, not counting the value of what would be inside. And he also said that he was going to offer $300 reward for its return. The safe itself is worth the amount of $250 to $300. He offered a $300 reward, but what happened to the safe? It was stolen. So you know how many times I've talked about evidence missing, evidence locked up, Phil, you know, on the political assassination?
Quite a few times.
Okay.
A lot of things, a lot of holes and a lot of theories.
Well, don't you think it's a little bit shocking to keep coming across this kind of handling of evidence on the murder of President John Kennedy?
Yeah, the question also is obvious. How, after 9 years, could there be evidence which hasn't been examined
by the war,
relating to the assassination, especially by a man who's killed the alleged assassin?
That's right. I mean, it becomes, I cross-file this, I have, you know, a lot of subject categories that I put this under. I put under coincidence, because the town of Athens is the home of the men, Mr. Murchison. We talked about the relationship of Hoover, Murchison, Nixon, Lyndon Johnson. The safe ended up in Athens, Texas, where it was stolen. Right after the political assassination of John Kennedy, a wealthy oil man in Colorado wanted to buy the rifle of Lee Harvey Oswald. And that could be very disposed and never seen again. That was stopped, and I think it's still in Washington somewhere. Its capability could be duplicated. We could shoot it and see if it could get that many bullets out in a certain time period if the investigation opened again. And to dump that rifle was terrible, but you see, people are sleeping. The nation is sleeping and is not aware of what's happening. So the safe made a trip, and it's gone now from the face of the earth. Now, talk about sleeping. I have to plug a movie in town that's playing at the Golden Bough, The Garden of Fisi Contini. It was made by Vittorio De Sica, and it's the story of a family in Italy, very well-off, very wealthy Jewish family, who opened up their garden to the Jews who couldn't go to the tennis courts anymore in Italy when fascism took over and the Nazis and Mussolini combined. And they had acres of a beautiful garden, and it's the story how generous they were to the Jews, the children who would knock on the gate and they could play tennis and use their grounds. And they were totally undisturbed until a knock comes on the door and the Fisi Contini and the whole family go off to the concentration camps to be murdered, just like the people in town, that they thought, if we keep quiet and don't say anything, all we have to do is stay home in our room. The son stayed home in his room because he felt as an outcast in town. And the Jews, they cut them off first. They couldn't have hired help, and they couldn't go to the schools, the public schools. They couldn't use the school libraries. And every time a new order came down, they didn't take it seriously because they thought, if we obey this one, we'll come out okay. They'll just leave us alone. We won't need their schools. We'll educate ourselves, and we don't need their tennis courts. And they went along with everything until it was their time, and they went too. And I have to say, it's playing now at the Golden Bough, and these movies come along very seldom, and the people in Carmel do not make a lot of money off these movies. These small theaters that show like Sacco Vanzetti and this one at the Golden Bough, I think you people should encourage them. Everyone complains about Vietnam and taxes and the warfare state, and they can't see themselves caught into the system. And it's a well-made movie. It won the award for the best foreign film this year. It's well-made, and it's pertinent into your complacency about, this is 9 years after the murder of John Kennedy, and all of Ruby's safe that was never opened has gone. Now, this is, we're talking about J. Edgar Hoover today. Where were his men when this safe was taken from I was in Dallas, and Ruby's nightclub became the Carousel Club is the police headquarters for training young people. They do boxing and things there. The Dallas police took over his nightclub. Why didn't the safe go to the Federal Bureau of Investigation in Washington?
Maybe it did.
Never open. Never open. The Warren Commission not only didn't use what was in Jack Ruby's safe in his personal files and contacts and telephone numbers, but they let it be stolen at this point, you know, shipped out to Athens, Texas. I want to talk about James Earl Ray today. His hearing for a new trial was turned down, but we'll finish up a little bit on Richard Nixon. When I talk about an article that was published this week by Emil D'Antonio, it was a beautiful article. Antonio was a young man who went to Harvard University and was in the service in the last war and got out, and he's made documentary movies. And he's a valuable person, like De Sica with his movie on the Garden. He did Point of Order, the McCarthy hearings, and he did Rush to Judgment, Mark Blaine's book. He did a photographic document, and he did The Year of the Pig on Vietnam, and he did Milhouse, the white comedy. And the article by Antonio is as close to anything that I've seen in print to the article that I'll have out in The Realist that comes out in June on how Richard Nixon came to power. It is the closest explanation of Richard Nixon that I have seen. And he goes into the fact that how Joe McCarthy was used and railroaded. And he made sort of a buffoon of himself, Antonio said. And there was a group there that decided to come down to McCarthy and get rid of him. And he used shots of McCarthy in the movie Milhouse purposely to show how hard McCarthy campaigned for Richard Nixon. But there came a time in Washington, in the White House, he said, where Richard Nixon and William Rogers, who's now Secretary of State, Henry Cabot Lodge, who was then U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., and Clark Clifford, who was a Democrat. Now, this group, William Rogers, Henry Cabot Lodge, Ambassador to the U.N., Clark Clifford, are all mentioned in the Pentagon Papers and the killing of Diem and a secret deal. Lodge was the ambassador to Vietnam at the time. Clark Clifford is the attorney who worked with... he's Howard Hughes' attorney, and he worked with Lyndon Johnson. There was a close tie-in, but this particular group that is mentioned by Antonio, Rogers, Cabot Lodge, Clark Clifford, and Nixon sat together, and they said, McCarthy is wrecking the Army and the country. He's sort of making a fool of himself. And he says McCarthy was done in because he broke the rules of the game and the establishment. McCarthy was a fascist. He had fascist ideas, and they accused him of being a drunkard. He had no group around him, no cliques or organization. He was power-hungry and so forth. And all the fascist elements of the country were behind him, including President Kennedy's father and the Texas millionaires. But he was an embarrassment to the intelligence community. And he goes on to say Nixon is the most intelligent creature that has been produced in the 20th century. The way he was down and out in 1962 and pulled himself up. And he goes into how these men could come down to McCarthy if he was an embarrassment to their general plan of power and schemes. He said what he was able to do in the Alger Hiss case is a key to what Richard Nixon is all about. And he goes into the details of this. This article's in the current issue of the Free Press. The Odyssey has them if anybody wants to pick those up. He says this is the one case where Nixon was caught red-handed as an outright lie. Now, he's talking about the Alger Hiss case. And today, Jack Anderson's talking about his outright lies in the Foreign Affairs Department of our country. And he said what he did to Alger Hiss was an outright lie. Whereas Nixon just said Alger Hiss, Nixon went after just Alger Hiss, and McCarthy went after the whole era. And he got Hiss sent to prison and himself to the White House. But J. Edgar Hoover held Richard Nixon through all these years and got him into the power he was in. But I don't think it's beyond Richard Nixon or Richard Helms or any of the powers that be, Howard Hughes or any of them, if Mr. Hoover becomes an embarrassment because of all these scandals and books that are coming out, if they can keep the publishers from embarrassing them and let everything come down on Hoover, and they wouldn't think twice about bidding adieu. John Connolly presented the flowers, Richard Nixon, the ceremony, but the record stands for itself, how Mr. Nixon acted way back in the early days and how he's performing today in the same manner. I think there's a consistency about Richard Nixon that people don't give him credit for.
And an obituary type review that I ran here on the station the day that Hoover died, we made reference to both seriously and through a comedic interpretation about what J. Edgar Hoover might or might not have on various people to keep himself in power for as long as he did. Do you really think that John Edgar Hoover could have avoided using the mounds of information that he must surely have come in contact with?
Could he have avoided using it?
Yeah.
No, this is why he accumulated them. You see, he accumulated it, and it was a double deal between each other. He accumulated this information to gain power, the power that he had.
Would you say that that's what kept him in power?
Well, you couldn't remove him from power. If the President of the United States or Richard Helms wants a particular agency to conduct the planning of the political assassinations, which was done through Mr. Hoover's racetrack friends in Montreal, Canada, and then came down to the various agents in the United States, if they could use him, they can't remove him. Now, I have a theory. You see, there was an article on the succession of the new FBI men in the paper this week, and they suggested Emil Younger or Sheriff Pitches of Los Angeles. And I have hit on Emil Younger almost weekly on Dialogue Assassination. So this next week, I will get out letters to as many members of Congress as I think have any backbone to them at all. I did this when they were considering an appointment to the Supreme Court, and they mentioned the possibility of Ronald Reagan's attorney or Mr. Compton, who worked with Emil Younger, and I sent out 100 personal letters to every member of the Senate that no appointment for the Supreme Court should come from this state until all the political assassinations are opened up for Texas. Now, to consider Emil Younger as the head of the Justice Department or Sheriff Pitches is to avoid opening up. In the Los Angeles Police Department, Younger and the LAPD have been involved in the assassination squads, the Robert Kennedy murder. Sheriff Pitches' department and the Special Enforcement Bureau of the Sheriff Department take care of the Chicano group, and they were involved with the Sharon Tate massacre, the La Bianca massacre, the Isla Vista affair, and the killing of Ruben Salazar, plus many, many others. I'm mentioning the most prominent that were killed. Sheriff Pitches and Emil Younger know too much about how the system works, so they have to get power. See, I keep one filing cabinet thing on people directly involved in political assassinations who worked their way up to positions of power afterwards. Jack Valenti, who worked for Lyndon Johnson, became the motion picture czar. He had no relationship to movies or I think the last picture you saw was the last picture show in the town in Texas. You know, Valenti became the motion picture czar. Leon Jaworski from the CIA Foundation, that was involved with the Warren Commission and represented the state of Texas, became president of the American Bar Association. John Connolly may become president of the United States because of what he knows in Dallas, because he publicly has said a different bullet hit me than has said Oswald. And he said it from the day of the assassination, and that's John Connolly's power. That's the source of his power, because he knows that if two bullets, separate bullets, hit him and the president, then Oswald couldn't do it alone. So these men used their power to elevate their position, and they have to be promoted because they know so much. And this is why I fear any man taking over the Justice Department. They're mentioning certain people from the head of Narcotics Bureau. The Narcotics Bureau are terrible in terms of political assassinations. Next week I'll bring in, we've got to summarize now, so next week I'll bring in a tape. I listened to it last week, a tape recording played on KPFK in Los Angeles, and I typed it up to read to you on the show about the contact man from the Tobacco, Alcohol, and Firearms Division working with Larry Shears on the arrangement to bring Cleaver home in a box, dead, as well as the planning to kill Cesar Chavez, a promotion of someone from the Treasury Department to the Justice Department. Can't be done till all of these evidences of conspiracy or attempt to murder or the diabolical use of people on narcotics raps to kill civil rights leaders, blacks and Chicanos and so forth, is exposed. People listening to me, if you have an interest or social conscience at all, write to your public officials, on your congressman, on the succession of the next head of the FBI. Congress will approve this time. You know, there was a bill passed in 68 that the new head of the FBI has to have the approval of Congress, not just appointed, like the cabinet members now. So no matter who wins the election in November, keep in mind who shouldn't be the head of the FBI.
Is that it for today?
Well, I can talk about James Earl Ray. Do we have much time?
No.
That's
Why
it?
Don't you just very briefly review the newsletter? How's that coming?
Well, the newsletter is coming really great. I wish we were ready to go to print. I work on it. It's like, man, I have all kinds of ideas, and I'm filling 28 different envelopes with columns. It'll be 28 columns.
Okay, so you're going to have this newsletter that'll be published every other week, and people can subscribe. And do you recall the address?
Yeah, 595 Broadway in care of the Realist. And it's New York 10012. I'd prefer you send $8 a year, then you'd get the Realist 6 issues a year. And I'll have that article on Richard Nixon. And I did another one. Paul's doing one on the Manson case, which fits in. Paul Krasner, the editor of Realist, which fits in with my talk about Manson on these shows. It's a part left out of the Manson book. And it's $8 for the Realist 6 times a year and the Conspiracy Newsletter 24. For $8, you'll get both publications.
Okay, that'll help you get a written account of what's going on.
Yeah, I have friends.
And more things you can't, you know, even in an hour on the air, you can't possibly transfer the written word to a radio program and get it all in.
No, we'll have books suggested reading, current books and old books and things to look up to document. Do your own research and become part of wanting to know what's happening. Don't be like the family in Italy that sat there and just played tennis and sipped tea. Become involved in what's happening, because it's happening.